Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome. Like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too. Like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to The Damcasters, brought to you in association with the Pima Air and Space Museum. I'm your host, Matt Bone. Back in History Hack Hedgehopping Days, which was the podcast I did before starting The Damcasters, we did an episode about what really happened with the 9th Troop Carrier Command on D-Day. So if you're to read the likes of Cornelius Ryan, more recently, you can break out James Holland, and of course Stephen Ambrose in Band of Brothers. All of those tales will look at the dropping of the 82nd Airborne and the 101st Airborne from the perspective of the paratroopers who ended up not where they were supposed to be. So in that episode, we welcomed two great guests. We had Flight Lieutenant Seb Davey, the bomber leader for the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight, and 9th Troop Carrier Command historian Adam Berry, who's a mate of mine. And a bit of a rock star, as you're going to find out today, and if you go back and watch that episode too. So we looked at the realities of what it takes to fly a C-47. That's where Seb came in. He flies one for the BBMF. It doesn't fly like you'd think. Now, load that up, overload it, even with paratroopers' equipment. Fly it at night in tight formation, and then hit a fog bank just before the drop zones come racing up on you. It was an interesting pod. Go back to listen to that if you want a bit more context, because what we're going to do today is talk about what the 9th TCC did next with Adam. And they did a lot. They were incredibly busy from the off, from the 7th of June straight through to the end of the war. Now, we're going to be talking about operations Freeport in Memphis, which is the resupply of the two airborne divisions. We're going to be talking about medical evacuation flights. We're going to be talking about Operation Dragoon. And we will be talking about the resupply to Bastogne, which is a great story in and of itself. We will not be covering Operation Market Garden because everybody else has covered that a lot. And we're going to be saving Operation Varsity, which is the airborne part of Operation Plunder, which was the crossing of Rhine in 1945, for its own episode. So we're going to kick this one off by looking back and quickly recapping that episode with Seb. And then Adam's going to take it away. We start delving into what the 9th Troop Carrier Command did next. Very enjoyably had an evening with the lovely Seb Davey from the Battle of Britain Memorial Flight a little while ago, and we talked about the realities of the 9th Troop Carrier Command on D-Day. So if you want all the background, how to fly a Dakota, links in the description below, dear listener, because that's, I think it was about an hour and a half of us just rabbiting on about C-47s on D-Day. But if you're coming to this one new and you're not going to disappear off for a bit to listen to that podcast, who were the 9th Troop Carrier Command, Adam? And sort of as a potted history, that as we're going to get into, yes, they supplied the airplanes the jumpy boys jumped out of, but who were they? what were they set up to do?
Okay, so officially 9th Troop Carrier Command were a, what the Americans called a tactical air support unit of the 9th Air Force, which is where they got their, you know, their 9th designation from. As the name suggests, their primary purpose was to provide aircraft for paratroopers to jump from and for gliders to be towed with to a combat mission, essentially. The troop carrier groups differed from a transport group in that they had a doctrine which had 4 or 5 points in it, but number one was always that their primary role was delivering airborne troops to combat in World War II. And they had to be ready to do that at any point. They had to be willing to drop what they were doing at any point in order to deliver airborne forces to combat. So 9 Troop Carrier Command was based in the UK from February 1944 until around about the same time, 45. It consisted of three wings, the 50th, the 52nd and the 53rd. And those three wings, between the three of them, contained 14 troop carrier groups, each of which had four squadrons. So the groups would consist roughly of about 18 aircraft each. 100 aircraft each. Excuse me. But on a combat operation, a squadron would normally furnish at least 18 aircraft each. So a serial would be 36 aircraft, and a group would fly 72 aircraft on a combat operation, roughly. It did increase ever so slightly as the war went on, but in a nutshell, so
was that to ensure any like technical issues? They had aircraft that they could slot straight in, things like that. Aircraft that were on checks, there was always the space to do it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like any unit that flies their aircraft over a combat zone where there's nasty people shooting up at them, aircraft were inevitably grounded with battle damage, technical malfunctions, you name it, so that there was always spare aircraft on charge. And a bit like, again, as you would find any, you know, research in bomb groups, it wasn't always the case that the same crew would fly the same aircraft every mission. You know, they flew what was available to them at the time. So,
So like we said before, the hedgehopping one that we did, we went into a lot of detail about the nature of flying the aircraft, the difficulties on D-Day itself. So what we're going to do in this one is talk about what happened next, isn't it? So we've got a lot to cover. We're going to say early on, dear listener, we're skipping Market Garden, Arnhem, mainly because that's sort of done to death elsewhere. And we're going to save Varsity, which was the crossing of the Rhine, the airborne element of Operation Plunder, for its own pod, because there's too much to get into with that, because there is a whole mess of things going on in early 1945 that probably needs its own time, and we've got enough to get through now. So the 9th does the famous drop, and if you've listened to the previous part, I'm pugging out as well because we had a lot of fun doing that one. It wasn't like Cornelius Rhind, Stephen Ambrose, and everybody said it. There were specific reasons why the drop happened as it did, but they get back and the turnaround is pretty quick. What happens next? Because in a lot of popular expressions, and I've heard people say this, that the transports don't really do anything until they start doing medevacs 3 weeks later. That's not true, is it? They are busy the whole time.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to point out is that once the para drops had taken place in the early morning hours of June 6th, almost immediately the command starts bringing gliders in. So there's actually five missions into Normandy on D-Day itself on the 6th of June, pulling gliders in. And the first one reaches the DZ just after 4 a.m. in the morning, so it's still dark. There's still an awful lot of activity in the air, activity on the ground. And then the four other flights, they land in Normandy in the evening of June 6th. So from the moment the day turns June 6th until the moment it turns June 7th, there are aircraft of 9 Troop Carrier Command in the air almost constantly, whether they're dropping paratroopers or they're bringing in gliders. You've also got the four glider missions that were carried out on the 7th of June to bring in the 325th Glider Infantry Regiment, which was one of the main regiments of the 82nd Airborne Division, who were brought in over the course of two missions in four flights. So landing in the early morning hours of June, well, I would probably call them early morning hours, but most people in the army wouldn't. But from 0700 onwards on the 7th of June, there was more gliders coming in to continue the flights, bringing the 82nd into Normandy. So yeah, for the first 24 hours, and then for the first two or three hours on the morning of the 7th of June, things are very busy for 9 Troop Carrier Command, and it doesn't really end there, because I'm sure we'll go into, they carry out two aerial resupply missions, one called Freeport and one called Memphis, to resupply the 101st and to resupply the 82nd Airborne Division on the 7th of June.
The plan clearly is do the drop, get the gliders in. But given what has happened with the misdrops and everybody coalescing as best they can, was Freeport and Memphis... So Freeport was the 82nd resupply and Memphis was the 101st, right?
Correct, yeah.
Yeah. So were those missions planned or were they spun up as a result of what had happened?
No, they were always planned. As with everything, they didn't go to plan. but they were missions that were predefined before D-Day was launched. Yes, they were always going to happen.
Okay. So you're an 82nd guy.
I am.
Having written extensively on it and more to come. We'll get back to that later. So let's look up from the ground first. What's the 82nd's situation when Freeport is launched to resupply them on the 7th?
So the 82nd situation on the ground is, it's okay, it's good, it's not ideal, but it's good. The plan for Freeport was always that that the resupply mission was going to carry the supplies over the Murderay River to the western side of the Murderay River. For those who are familiar with Normandy, the Murderay runs almost north to south. Two regiments of the 82nd were dropped on the west side, so essentially they were cut off from the Utah Beach side of the river, if that makes sense. So the idea was to drop the supplies to them because they were the ones that were more likely to need them, because the supply trains coming in from Utah Beach would be a little bit longer in getting to them and relieving them. As it happened, it didn't really turn out that way. The official records indicate that the drop for the 82nd took place northeast of St. Mary-Glise, but again, anyone with a sort of fairly decent knowledge of Normandy and the operations, particularly in the 82nd area, will know that much of that area was in, at that point, by the 7th of June, was in friendly hands. And by that point as well, also, the 4th Infantry Division had hooked up with the 82nd in St. Mary-Glise, and therefore there was a supply chain, albeit a fairly modest improvised supply chain, but the supplies were coming inland from Utah Beach by that point. The actual drop appears to have taken place in the area between the two Murderay crossings. So one at Lafayette, which is obviously a very popular tourist attraction. It's where the Iron Mike statue is, the bridge at Lafayette, and the manor is, it's one of the hottest tourist spots in Normandy. The slightly lesser known bridge
now, at the time, it wasn't a place you'd want a holiday.
No, absolutely not. No, even on the 7th of June, well, particularly on the 7th of June, things were, at that point, there was not really any certainty that the 82nd success in seizing the bridge and the causeway and actually using it to push the bridgehead further west had succeeded. The Germans had done a pretty good job of keeping the paratroopers very well sort of entrenched around the bridge, and the situation was precarious, to say the least. The lesser known bridge further to the south, just on the western outskirts of Chef DuPont, was also a key crossing point for the Americans in that area to move west beyond the Murderay River. And it looks as though the supplies were dropped in the field between those two bridges to the east of the river, to resupply the forces that were essentially fighting at those bridges in order to ensure that any risk of those positions collapsing was minimised. Unfortunately, as was the case on the 6th of June, the weather on the 7th of June was still pretty poor. And the mission was flown in the darkness hours, much like the paradrop was the previous day. And a significant cloud bank. We spoke a lot about cloud banks on the last pod.
Goodness, the clouds, it's bringing back memories.
Yeah. It forced quite a number of the aircraft that were flying a Freeport mission to basically abandon the mission. So some of them didn't even sort of leave the UK. They hit a cloud bank and they basically put the aircraft down as low as they could get it in order to see where they were. And then the first airfield they came across, they dumped themselves down at these airfields in order to obviously prevent aerial collisions or getting lost, or for similar situations like what happened the night before happening again. Of those aircraft that did make it through, they found that actually the German flak was significantly worse than it was the previous night. So on the night of the first mission, even though the 101st Airborne Division had preceded the 82nd by quite some time, by just under an hour, the Germans were preoccupied in trying to figure out what was going on and to assess the airborne drops, and were obviously still reeling from the surprise of thousands of American paratroopers descending down on their heads. On the second day, the situation had settled down ever so slightly. So when the aircraft were flying overhead, German flak was ready for them. They were much more alert, and the ground forces that had anything capable of inflicting damage on a C-47, anything from an MG-42 on an anti-aircraft mount, was firing up at the aircraft. So we actually lost 11 aircraft shot down to enemy gunfire on the Freeport mission, which is it's less than it was the night before, but for the 52nd Troop Carrier Wing, which was the wing carrying out the mission, the Freeport mission, the losses were a lot higher than they were the night before. So the Freeport mission doesn't go as swimmingly as one might hope, or have hoped.
How did Memphis go?
Memphis was better. They had a similar situation with aircraft having to turn around because of the weather, but they only lost, I say only, they lost three aircraft on the operation. So again, the 52nd Wing, it took quite a beating on the night of the Freeport mission. The worst story actually to come out of Freeport was, as I say, the mission was launched in the darkness hours. So the aircraft were taxiing out from their hard stands at their various airfields in the darkness. And of course, a lot of the airfields at this time of the war were still in blackout conditions, or as close to blackout conditions as they could be. And taxiing at night was difficult, say the least. And two aircraft of the 316th Troop Carrier Group taxied into one another on the ground at RAF Cottesmore. It significantly damaged one of them, but the other one had the entire nose section of the aircraft essentially chopped off by the propeller of the other one. And unfortunately, the pilot of the aircraft that was piloting the aircraft had its nose chopped off, had both his legs severed, and didn't survive. So for the 316th, Freeport was not going well before the aircraft had even left the ground. And for those who have got Volume 1 of mine and Hans's book, there are pictures of those aircraft on the ground at Cottesmore showing the extent of the damage. And it just goes to demonstrate the difficulties that these men had flying aircraft that didn't really have all of the technological gizmos that aircraft have these days in doing a simple task like taxiing it out to the runway, basically.
And you have to remember, aircraft collide with everything on the ground now. It's not a completely unheard of thing, but when you've got that many aircraft heavily laden, full of fuel, and you're already pretty knackered after what you've done before, accidents will happen, and that's pretty tragic.
Yeah, I mean, the guy that was killed with the 316th, he had flown the Neptune mission the night before, so he'd flown an aircraft that dropped paratroopers of the 82nd over Normandy. So, essentially less than 24-hour turnaround for him. And you can see why mistakes like that get made, because, the mission time wasn't huge, in terms of the hours we were in the air on the 6th of June. But when you factor in the stress levels and everything that comes with a combat mission, the weight on the shoulders of these men in terms of dropping, making sure that they do a good job in dropping, you know, the two American airborne divisions is pretty big. And obviously it's easy for us to sit back and say, you know, they're only in the air for 6 hours or whatever. But as you know, Boney, back in those days, these aircraft weren't fly-by-wire. They were difficult to fly. And as I say, with the added stress, you can see why these fairly short periods of their day would be extremely exhausting for them. And then, like I say, less than 24-hour turnaround, they're back in the air again to go back over the same area they were over the night before. So, yeah, it's difficult.
How much did they drop? I think I read it was about 100 tons of supplies, something like that. Or am I catching you on the hop there? Because that's not.
I did write it down. I did write it down. Yes. Where did I write it down? I can't remember if I did it. I will come back to you on that one. I wrote lots of. I might have lost it because I've written an awful lot of random numbers down of the number of supplies dropped and things like that. So.
Let's not worry about that. Let's get on to the general supply grind, because that's what starts kicking in next. It's regular flights over the beachhead, getting supplies in. As they're building up the ALGs, as they're building up that sort of massive weight of force in it. So what's happening between Freeport and Memphis through to the establishment of the advanced landing grounds, which allowed them to actually land?
Okay, well, they didn't actually fly any resupply missions until the ALGs were completed. So there was no more parachute resupplying, if you want to call it that. But the C-47 was capable of essentially landing on a field, and there are instances of where aircraft have brought in vital supplies by landing on the ALGs before they've been finished. But essentially, within a few days, the advanced landing grounds are in a position where the aircraft can start bringing supplies in. And of course, at this point, the Allies are still building the Mulberry Harbours. So what the C-47s are bringing in is absolutely critical in keeping the American effort in that area of the beachhead going.
So it is the focus on the west side. Are they bringing supplies in, or are they doing it for all three armies?
No,
by saying American, British, and Canadian.
No, they're mainly doing it for the American side. But one thing that is worth pointing out at this point is that one of the key things that 9th Troop Carrier Command had to keep themselves prepared for is the fact that there were plans for them to actually drop the British 1st Airborne Division into Normandy. Now, not many people are aware that this was ever part of the overall sort of encapsulated plan for Normandy. But prior to it all being launched, there was always a tentative plan for them to drop the 1st Airborne Division just outside of Caen. And in actual fact, after D-Day had taken place and the Freeport mission was out of the way, a load of the high-ranking generals and those in the position of power in 9th Troop Carrier Command and in the 1st Airborne Division met up in order to finalise these plans. But there was considerations taken over the position of German forces in where the drop zones would originally have been. And, of course, the fact that the fighting was so intense around there and so fluid and changed so often that it was considered too dangerous a mission to carry out. So 9th Troop Carrier Command were, for want of better terminology, you know, on standby to carry out this mission. And whilst that was the case, they weren't really, you know, putting too much consideration into the resupply flights, because delivering the 1st Airborne Division was at the time the greater priority. In hindsight, we can look back now and say not doing that was probably a good move, because the 9th Troop Carrier Command probably would have lost an awful lot of aircraft on a mission like that, dropping troops in that area.
The first would have been ripped to pieces as well.
Very likely, yes. Yeah. And then, of course, you've got ramifications knocking. Does Market Garden happen if the 1st Airborne Division had dropped into Normandy? Things like that, you know. It's so it's these little decisions that can change the way the whole war goes, really. But yeah, so they're really thinking at the time about the pending delivery of the 1st Airborne Division, which is something that I think anyone that had done the June 6th missions into Normandy would have been thinking, yeah, I'm not sure I fancy this one.
It's one of those things because it's they keep looking at what they can do with the first, isn't it? There's, I think, is it four or six operations that are spun up to try to aid the breakout. That I guess that keeps, as we're going to go on to talk about with medical evacuation and the supply flights, that's keeping an element of that always with one hand tied behind the back because they're trying to find a way to use the first, aren't they? And it's
I guess that's
an interesting consideration for you when you're looking at it as well.
Yeah, and as I say, you know, going back to what I said at the start of the pod with the doctrine that the troop carrier groups had, that their primary role was delivering airborne forces. So that, you know, there would have always been that overhanging risk isn't the right word, but chance that they're all of a sudden going to be pulled off whatever it is they're doing to go and drop an airborne division. And of course, they'd have done whatever they were tasked to do. But in this instance, I think not doing it was certainly the right choice.
Because it just needs to be said, as we talked about in the other pod, go listen to that, dear listener. They had done a lot of training with the airborne troops as well. So their primary focus was actually dropping it. It wasn't these guys piling in the back and then figuring out how to do it on the day, was it?
No, yeah. The Americans actually really, really, really enjoyed training with the British. At the earlier stages of training in the UK around sort of the March, April time, the Americans were of the opinion that close liaison with the British airborne divisions was much better than it was with the Americans. And if you actually look at the troop carrier command records, the success rates on airborne exercise with the British is significantly higher. Whether or not that's, you know, it's down to the fact that I think we'd been at it for a little bit longer when it came to using airborne forces. I don't know, but yeah.
We'll leave that for another show. Woody can worry about that on World War II TV.
Yeah.
One of the things that always strikes me when, especially looking at Normandy, the operations from the advanced landing grounds, which is where most of my head gets to with the Normandy battles with typhoons, as soon as they could come over in late June or early June until they started getting shelled and they had to pull them out again, and the dust, another podcast, is the medical evacuation flights, because... Yeah. There are some amazing imagery of how they reconfigure the C-47s. They have flying nurses on board. So you have women in what are still forward areas performing life-saving work. And also it means you're getting guys back to proper medical facilities within hours as opposed to days.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we did a big section in Volume 1 about the medical air evacuation squadrons, as they were known, because they're always referred to as being a unit attached to a troop carrier group or to a troop carrier wing. But I actually think that these guys and girls should have been very much considered to have been part of a troop carrier group, because the mission that they, the job that they did was so incredibly vital, so incredibly important to the survival of so many wounded soldiers. Because, of course, anyone that suffered from a particular type of injury, or anyone that had got an injury that was severe enough that they needed a particular type of care very urgently, you know, these aircraft became extremely vital and extremely vital to them. I've actually got some numbers in terms of the number of wounded soldiers.
You wrote these ones down, did you?
I did write these ones down. Yeah. Because it's I actually find the numbers that they flew out quite mind-blowing, to be honest with you. So in June alone, they fly 15,000 wounded soldiers out of Normandy.
Sorry, 15,000.
15,000, yeah. So one of the things that I'm always keen to point out, the 9 Troop Carrier Command diaries always like to mention it, but it also makes perfect sense, is that they tried never to fly a C-47 anywhere empty, because... Why would you?
Yeah.
So they would fly supplies out to an ALG, and they'd park at a certain area of an ALG and get all these supplies dumped out, and then they'd taxi to another area of it where they'd pick up wounded personnel. And this is where the nurses really come into it, because, and I always refer back to, for anyone that's familiar with Band of Brothers, and the whole Bastogne scene and the and Doc Rowe in the seminary with the French nurse, and there's a line in Band of Brothers where he looks at her and he says, "Your touch calms people." And it's funny because the Nine Troop Carrier Command diary uses words very similar to that, that the nurses had a calming effect on men when they were treating them on board these aircraft. They had ways of calming their emotions, settling them down, almost alleviating some of the effects that come naturally with shock just by being there, just by touching these men, basically. And I genuinely don't think that the importance of that can be overstated. The other thing as well is that, as with a lot of medical facilities that were established in Normandy at the time, they weren't just catering for the care of Allied soldiers. They were taking Germans back to the UK for treatment, or any, you know, any other Axis force or Axis soldier that was wounded back to the UK for treatment. Now, when you think about the fact that in some cases they were picking these men up from airfields that were 5 or 6 miles back from the front lines, imagine the tension that would have been on board the aircraft, you know, soldiers of both nationalities been on board. But these nurses just had a knack of just completely disarming the situation and calming it all down. And there was I can't remember the quote exactly, there was a German who had been struck by artillery, and the blast on him was so vicious that it ripped everything off him. And I mean everything, bar one boot. And he was loaded on board this aircraft in that state, basically. He was on a stretcher under a blanket. But the nurse tried to take this one boot from him. And the German didn't want this boot taken from him because it was the one piece he'd got left of, you know, everything that he had, basically. And the story is that this nurse sympathised with this German, and that she helped this German feel welcome on board the aircraft, and that she calmed the Americans that were around him down. And, you know, this German basically attributes this nurse to, you know, saving his life, basically. I think stories like that are great because, there's sides of war that you don't too often get to read about, because, you know, war is war. A lot of what we read about is about people getting killed, unfortunately. And it's nice to see the other side of it on the odd occasion. But yeah, I mean, their job, to go into 5 minutes of detail on it, was their job was to meet with ground-based medics when the aircraft was on the ground, and they would assess how many men they could get on board the aircraft, basically. The aircraft was capable of having stretchers on racks that hung down from the fuselage, 6 on either side of the fuselage, so they could have 12 stretcher patients on board the aircraft. But they could also get anybody that was capable of sitting or even standing on board the aircraft. But these nurses also had to have a decent knowledge of what the aircraft's gross takeoff capacity was. Obviously, they would work with the aircrew, but they would have to know that, you know, they couldn't, for example, have more than 20 guys on board the aircraft, but they would squeeze on as many as they could. And then it was their job to make sure that these guys were looked after whilst they were on board the plane. And then the aircraft would fly to the UK, and invariably they would fly to an airfield that was close to a general hospital somewhere in England. And as far as the aircrew and the flight nurses are concerned, off they would go. But yeah, they were very special women, very important women to keeping an awful lot of guys alive at that stage of the war.
Utter angels, really.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I just to bring another number in. So obviously I mentioned that they flew 15,000 out in June. The busiest month for them was actually August 44. They flew 23,000 out in the month of August. But between June 44 and December 44, 9 Troop Carrier Command flew 125,000 wounded personnel out of the ALGs in Europe back to the UK. So it's a huge number of men, and you have to think that a decent percentage of those men would have died without it.
Clearly, yeah, as you read about the medical facilities being spun up on the continent, they get a lot better. But from your numbers there, just in those few months, I guess with the advance as well, it's moving those things forward. Yeah, most people will think of mass units, but those things don't shift easy, and what they then had 5 years later was not what they had at the time of the Second World War. So evacuating back to the UK, where hospitals were ready and waiting and had been preparing for years for this sort of thing, was very, very something. I find those accounts of the evac flights really, really something, because it's in all of them you just read there's a, I don't want to say passion, but there's a determination of the crews and the nurses to do the job. Yeah, you know, that it's not just flying stuff. It's, you know, this that flight almost sort of meant more to them than it did some of the other stuff. Maybe from a drop perspective aside.
Yeah, absolutely. And the one thing as well that's worth pointing out is that for 9-2 Carrier Command, this was every day. You know, it was every day. So it was, they were doing their bit.
We're going to take a quick break so that we can get the latest from the Pima Air and Space Museum with Head of Collections, Andrew Bowley.
Here we are at the Pima Air and Space Museum with some of our Korean War vintage aircraft. Here is our F-86E Sabre, which was the preeminent American jet fighter during the Korean conflict. Originally, we were flying a lot of straight-wing aircraft like the F-84 and, you know, reciprocating engine aircraft still like the Mustang, various other aircraft. When this aircraft made its debut, the MiG-15, which was used by the North Koreans, with also probably some help from other nations. But it was a game changer, swept wings, had a cannon, and really, you know, overpowered anything with a straight wing. Around that time, our F-86 started coming into Korea, which the two aircraft were pretty equally matched. Armament aside, you know, the F-86 had 50 calibers, while the MiG had, I believe, 20-millimeter cannons, if I recall correctly. Three?
30-millimeter, I think it was.
Was it 30-millimeter?
Two 30, 220, something like that, yeah.
Okay. Cannon. Not the armaments. They're cannons versus machine guns, which has always been a big argument. You know, the Americans were always full in on the 50 cal and the machine gun side of things, while a lot of other nations tended to lean towards cannons. You know, so depends who you ask which is the better aerial weapon. But our F-86 is actually a real combat veteran. It flew with the 51st Fighter Interceptor Wing. It's a bit of a Franken airplane. The fuselage did come from a Korean War veteran. The wings did come from another aircraft, but that was one of those things where we decided to go with, obviously, the identity of the fuselage, which, you know, has the more interesting history and has an actual Korean War combat provenance. It could be a little bit of a time, too, to talk about our curatorial choices with paint schemes.
Yes.
Usually we always try to paint our aircraft in markings that are historically accurate for that aircraft. This F-86 is an example of this. The markings on the aircraft are based on photographic evidence from the Korean War of this aircraft. Our MiG-15, on the other hand, like most surviving MiGs in a lot of collections, it's a Polish MiG. It's not a Korean MiG. But because for this, we decided we wanted to tell the story of the Korean War, so we did paint this aircraft in North Korean markings, where usually we don't do that. We usually always try to paint the aircraft for, you know, the historically accurate markings for that aircraft. But like I said, once in a while, when we have another story to tell, we'll make an assumption. Also, if we painted all our MiGs, they would all be pretty much in Polish markings instead of representing some of the different Warsaw Pact nations like we have.
To learn more about what is on display and what events are coming up at the Pima Air and Space Museum in Tucson, Arizona, please do check out their website at www.pimaair.org.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
And now, back to the show.
So you said about the numbers getting up to August. You said 20-odd thousand in August. But
yeah,
they have a bit of a distraction in August, don't they? Because some of them have head to the south of France, and that's not for holidays. What percentage of the units in the UK get retasked with heading down to support Operation De Groom, which is dropping the first airborne task force, which is that sort of amalgamation of different units that they dropped into the south of France?
Yeah, so eight of the groups that were made at the command of the 14 end up flying to Italy for Operation Dragoon. So I don't know what that is percentage-wise, 55, 60%, I guess. Mm-hmm. I'm not a mathematician.
Lots.
So it's eight groups. It's a total of 413 aircraft of the command fly off to southern Italy. And what's interesting about it is that although Dragoon's obviously not, it doesn't take place until mid-August, they actually fly out there in the middle of July. So 9 Troop Carrier Command loses more than 50% of its charge of aircraft for Dragoon for over a month. And aside from the aircraft that they lose their commanding officer because Major General Paul Williams, who is the commanding officer of 9 Troop Carrier Command, he goes out to Italy because he wants to personally oversee the planning and the training and the execution of Dragoon. And the 52nd Troop Carrier Wing lose their XO, a guy called Colonel Dick Petty, who was second in command of the 52nd Wing, who, although the 52nd Wing actually didn't take part in Dragoon, he goes out there to act as the chief of staff and does an awful lot of planning and actually flies the operation himself as well. So they lose a decent number of aircraft for a significant amount of time.
Which makes those numbers in August being medevaced out even more remarkable when you're thinking it's a subset of the whole group.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Of the whole command, there's multiple groups. The way the USAF set things up, it's not easy to remember all the different.
It's funny when you talk of squadrons from a US Air Force point of view, it's very different to RAF, and yeah, it can be very confusing. But yeah, absolutely. They for them to have flown 23,000 wounded personnel out of out of France in August 44, given the significant reduction of aircraft and manpower that they have available to them, is very impressive. And I'm sure for those that were remained back in the UK, it was the 52nd Troop Carrier Wing in its entirety, so five groups of the 52nd Wing and then one group of the 53rd Troop Carrier Wing remained in the UK, they would have been very busy.
That's the thing to remember, dear listener, that whereas in the RAF it goes group, wing, squadron, in the US Air Force it goes wing, group, squadron. Do it all the same. Come
well,
on.
It's similar with the airborne divisions in the way that, you know, we had the Americans had regiments and battalions, and we had brigades and battalions, and different terminology, different ways of it can be very confusing.
Yeah, let's not get into that now, but let's talk about Dragoon. Dragoon is interesting because it's, to my reading anyways, for the most part, it's completely overshadowed by what's going on in the north. And yet it's not easy. You've got difficult terrain. You have the axis of events, which cuts almost straight towards the mountains, doesn't it, as they sort of try to swing round into northern Italy as well. What happens for the drop of the first ATF as well? Because there's been, I'm thinking of Kershaw's book, was it Liberators, that talks about the
45th,
yeah. So they've gotten a little bit of what's going on the ground. But what happens with the airborne element of Dragoon? Where are they being dropped? Are they getting somewhere nice like Toulon or Marseille, or are they getting dropped somewhere a bit more nasty?
No, they're getting dropped in nice areas. They're getting dropped in all the vineyards and all of the nice lush valleys. Actually, Dragoon is probably the most successful airborne operation of the Second World War. from a standpoint of the success of the drops themselves, and also from a standpoint of the aircraft that are involved. So what's interesting about Dragoon is that a unit called the PTCAD is established, and it stands for the Provisional Troop Carrier Air Division is established. And the reason why they do this is because the entirety
I'm sure they were on a bonus for acronyms.
yeah. Well, I find that with a lot of researching with a lot of American stuff, they'll take any opportunity to create a new unit that they're given, basically. And this was clearly one. So the 50th Troop Carrier Wing, which was part of 9 Troop Carrier Command and Station in the UK, they go over. All four groups of that wing go over. Four of the five wing groups of the 53rd Troop Carrier Wing go over. But then there are also two groups of the 51st Troop Carrier Wing, which are not part of 9 Troop Carrier Command, that fly the Dragoon mission. And these are the originals. These were the guys that dropped what became the 509th Parachute Infantry Battalion in North Africa in November 1942. They were the trailblazers. And these guys have pretty much always been stationed in the Mediterranean theatre, which up until later on in the war, they spend most of their time there. So they were clearly always going to be involved in Dragoon. So when all of these aircraft are out there and all of these various groups are out there, the Provisional Troop Carrier Air Division is what they all came under. I've not done a lot of research into the 51st Troop Carrier Wing. Some friends of mine, Mark Valos, he's done a book about one of the groups. So if anyone wants to read up about them, there are books out there. But from a 9 Troop Carrier Command standpoint, so the groups that flew from England for the operation, Dragoon was incredibly successful. Probably the worst of the drops was that there were a couple of aircraft that dropped one unit 5 miles from their drop zone, which for a paratrooper is a 20-minute hike, really, whilst also picking grapes off vineyards and on whatever bottles you find.
And realistically, that's hitting the green light, doing the math. It's not long, is it?
To be 5 miles off your drop zone, you could probably be a minute to 90 seconds past the drop zone, basically, something like that. Yeah, it's very, very minimal, and realistically, it could have been caused by the fact that on the morning of the operation there was a little bit of ground haze. You know, something as simple as that could have thrown this group off course. But they lose one aircraft on the entire operation. Wow. And it actually crashes on takeoff, so it's not even shot down by the enemy. So, you know, there are some groups that don't report having experienced any flak at all flying into or out of the drop zones. So it is what I guess you could define, or some would define, as a milk run for 9 Troop Carrier Command. They do also, of course, also assign somewhere in the region of 750 glider pilots to the operation, because a number of the units are around about 40% of First Airborne Task Force is glider-borne. So there's an awful lot of gliders involved in the operation as well, which is surprising that so many gliders were allocated to the operation, considering the number that were used in Normandy and the number that would later go on to be used in Market Garden, and obviously the logistical difficulties they have in supplying the right number of gliders for these various operations. But they do.
It's because you're thinking that's probably a month before getting gliders on boats, getting them down to North Africa. Yeah. And then, of course, the glider pilots are incredibly rare beasts in the great scheme of things as well, aren't they? So,
the glider pilots, not only, as you say, were they rare, the casualty rates amongst them were a lot higher as well. So you would lose more glider pilots every operation that was carried out, whether it was successful or not, because gliders tended to crash land whether they were landed properly or not, you know, because there were objects on the ground that they would strike. And it sometimes didn't matter how well the pilot put it down on the deck. They took a while to slow down, particularly if they had heavy equipment on board. And the area that the drop zones were, as I say, they were in valleys. They were relatively flat vineyard areas and things like that. Imagine owning a vineyard and having a flight of Waco's just rip through the whole thing. But
I can hear my wife screaming.
It's an operation that's it might not be Normandy and it might not be Market Garden in terms of costs, but it's still costly to 9th Troop Carrier Command, and they do lose. I think I read that they lost somewhere in the region of 24, 25 glider pilots. Not all as fatalities, but some were injured beyond being able to carry out another operation again. So, but they do ultimately have to replace these guys.
So what happens after? Do they move into that same sort of flow that we would have seen in Normandy, that they're flying resupply, that they're then, as the airfields are being captured in the south of France, they're being able to medevac? Or because of the subject we're not going to talk about, are they then being rushed back north to the UK, getting ready for Arnhem?
They're not rushed back north, but they go back fairly quickly, yeah. Resupply missions for Dragoon are fairly minimal. There's certainly no pre-planned, like Freeport or Memphis situations in terms of resupplies. Anything beyond the first day anyway. So eventually the groups make their way back to the UK, and any resupplies that are needed in that area, they're handled by the 51st Troop Carrier Wing and the groups of that wing that are going to remain in that area.
So like I said, we're going to skip Market Garden in its entirety. I think it's been covered to death. I was saying to Adam before we started that it's one of the ones I'm going to try to avoid, because I think it gets covered a lot.
Yeah.
And this
podcast would quite easily be 3 or 4 hours long if we started talking about Market Garden. So it's...
That's it. When you sent over the list of what they got up to, I was like, well Market Garden's a couple hours at least. Yeah. Varsity's going to be a long one. So let's talk about the other things. Because we get to get into what happens after Market Garden. Because Market Garden, as we know, doesn't go terribly well, dear listener. Spoiler. How does the 9th come out of it as they start to regroup after that operation, as they head into October, November time? What's happening before the counterattack in Ardennes? Because there's a lot of flux, there's a lot of movement, but then there's also a lot of suddenly solidifying. Because I know for the tactical air forces, they're being rushed into that area at a great rate, and not so much so 440 Squadron literally gets lost for 2 days because they have to land at a random airfield and they can't get fuel. So it's quite a fluid situation going on. How are the 9th fitting into this as they're getting ready for the what they all consider the big push in the new year? But of course,
yeah,
Germans have other ideas.
Yes, they fall back very much into post-Normandy type stuff, resupply missions and medical air evacuation flights. November was a particularly busy month for them in terms of the medical air evacuation flights. They took 19,000 out in November, so that was clearly quite a... which I presume would coincide to when the Americans started that fruitless effort in the Hurgen Forest around that time.
And you've got Canadians in the Scheldt as well, and...
That's absolutely, yeah. So,
got to keep mentioning them, mate. You know how
well,
this goes.
Yeah, absolutely. actually, one of the biggest issues that 9th Troop Carrier Command had at that point was an issue of morale, because prior to Market Garden being launched, as you alluded to earlier, there were a number of airborne operations that the Allies were planning to attempt to sort of force units like the 1st Airborne Division into some sort of action that ended up being cancelled because the DZs were overrun. And after Market Garden took place, there was rumours here and there that there would be other airborne operations, and then the rumours would slowly disappear. So all the way through the sort of very, very latter stages of September through to the end of November and midway into December, when, as you say, Mr. Hitler decides he's going to have one last go, they think that their use as troop carrier forces is done. And there's a number of the group's diaries refer to this issue that they have of morale with the men. They actually have an issue with discipline, which is marginally concerning. But eventually, Eisenhower himself has to hand out this directive, which is basically that all of these troop carrier airfields have to start operating almost like Heathrow and properly start to look at who's jumping on board the aircraft when they go off to these resupply missions, because what they were finding was that men were getting so bored that they were just deciding that they were going to go on furlough to Paris, for example. And they would jump on board these aircraft. But what they would do is they'd take two or three of their English girlfriends with them as well, off on holiday on these C-47s over to mainland Europe to see the sights. And Eisenhower decided that he needed to put a stop to that. So as weird as it sounds, for 9 Troop Carrier Command, the Battle of the Bulge comes at just about the right time for them, because it reignites them into this realisation that actually they do still have a purpose beyond heaving a load of crates of ammunition on board their aircraft and flying it over and then, you know, bringing wounded soldiers back. They are going to start working with the airborne divisions again in some way, shape or form.
So where are they based by this point? Have they moved across to the continent, or are they still operating from the UK?
Some are operating from the continent. Some are operating still from the UK. It's probably about a 60-40 split in favour of operating from the UK, which turns out to be obviously of benefit, particularly with what's to come. So obviously Hitler launches his counter-offensive in the Ardennes, and we see the story of the 101st Airborne Division being surrounded at Bastogne, and the inclement weather, and it grounding all of the airplanes, and we all know the story of the first sort of week or so of the Battle of the Bulge and how that went. 9 Troop Carrier Command are made aware of the German offensive the day that it's launched. So on some of the war diaries, there's mention of particularly some of the higher-ranking officers being taken into the briefing rooms, or the war rooms, as they might have called them, and basically being made aware of the German counter-offensive. And essentially, it's their job to trickle that news down to all the men and make sure that they are ready for what might come. And they're given fairly early indications of what that might be. And obviously, it doesn't take a genius to know that there's probably going to be some sort of resupply to the area, because they already, even in the very early stages, they know that there are units cut off from friendly forces. And there's also a mention of potentially air landing American units that are based in the UK in France, so that they can be sent to the front, basically. And in short, it all turns out to be what 9 Troop Carrier end up doing. And it's all encapsulated under an operation called Operation Repulse. And whether or not that word is purposefully termed, given the context of the battle, I don't know. But the primary mission for them is to resupply the 101st Airborne Division. But obviously the weather makes that very difficult for them. So they sat at the airfield waiting for the green light to go and take these supplies to the 101st. And the weather keeps telling them that it can't happen. And eventually it gets to the point, and it was similar actually to the situation with deploying the Polish paratroopers at Graf during Operation Market Garden, which we're not allowed to mention. But in that instance, the troop carrier pilots stood up and said, you know what, whether or not, we have got to go and do this job, because otherwise things are going to go pear-shaped pretty quickly. So during the Battle of the Bulge, it's very much what happens. The American troop carrier forces know that in order to reach the 101st at Bastogne, where there might be good pockets of weather, they need to fly through some of the crappy stuff first. And that's what they do. So from the 22nd to the 29th of December, the 9 Troop Carrier Command launch a number of major operations, Repulse being a combination of delivering aerial resupply missions to the 101st Airborne Division. Well, I'm loath actually to say the 101st. I'll say American forces at Bastogne, because, of course, we know it wasn't just the 101st.
But Band of Brothers says it's just
them. I didn't want to bring that up. But let's say the American forces at Bastogne, and also to the 106th Infantry Division at Marquerie. My lack of French accent on that, I do apologise for, but that one is one of those ones. So there's the two aerial resupply missions to Marquerie and Bastogne. But the biggest mission of all, actually, in terms of the sheer weight of it, is that they airland. And by airland, I mean we're not talking about a parachute deployment here. We're talking about taking off and landing with these personnel on board. They airland the entirety of the 17th Airborne Division in France. who are based down near Tidworth Barracks in Tidworth in Wiltshire.
I think so.
I should know that. So that, in terms of sheer weight of transportation and numbers and aircraft, is massive, because obviously the 17th Airborne Division, they are an airborne division, but they've still got artillery pieces. They've got glider field artillery battalions. They've got parachute field artillery battalions. You know, 9 Troop Carrier Command's got to move all of their artillery pieces. It's got to move every single man of a division over on board its aircraft to air land them in France. And it's a massive undertaking.
I was going to look it up, because the 17th arrive too late to be trained for Market Garden, don't they? So they're fresh to get dropped in December, isn't that right? I'm scrambling because you're my go-to airborne guy, and I usually ask you these questions. So I'm going to ask you. they're not one of the more, I don't want to say famous, but they're not one of the ones that have had a fancy book written about them, have they?
No, they often get overlooked, yeah. But the 17th Airborne Division were as good as they come in terms of airborne divisions. They were very well trained and an excellent commanding general. But yes, they were too late for Normandy. They were too late for Market Garden. There were plans to, I think there were even considerations taken over whether or not they could be deployed by parachute during the Battle of the Bulge. But logistically, it just didn't seem like the right way to get them to combat for that particular engagement.
They will reappear, dear listener, when we do our Plundervarsity.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the things, obviously, that again is not too familiar to people, is that one of the regiments in the 17th Airborne Division did jump into Normandy. That was the 507th, because they were only really attached to the 82nd on a temporary basis. So, in the end of August 1944, they're attached to the 17th Airborne Division. So, when the 17th do enter combat during the Battle of the Bulge, the 507th do actually give them that slight combat edge, but they otherwise are a green unit who perform pretty well in the first few days of their baptism by fire.
There's so much to talk about over the resupplies, in especially Bastogne. Yeah, we'll call it Bastogne because that's the only.
I do actually have the number of the weight of supplies they dropped to the 101st.
You see, after our earlier point, I'm a bit worried about asking numbers. Go for it, mate. What have you got?
Yeah. Well, they dropped £139,000 of equipment to the American forces that were surrounded at Bastogne during repulse. So it's decent. It's a decent amount of equipment. And of course, this was all deployed under parachute. None of it was air landed, but there was also glider missions. So a lot of it was landed by glider as well. But it was carried out in the truest sense of an airborne resupply. What's interesting about it is that from a 101st Airborne Division perspective, this is the moment in the war where all of a sudden the members of the 101st, if you read the likes of Don Burgett's books, for example, it's the moment in the war where the 101st go, you know what, these guys are actually quite brave. Because in order to reach the drop zones that had been identified by the 101st at Bastogne, first of all, they need to drop a Pathfinder team. So you've got aircraft that are flying Pathfinder teams of the 101st Airborne Division into the perimeter, which is a dodgy job in its own right.
It's low and slow, isn't it?
It's very low and slow. And then the aircraft themselves flying the main serials, by very nature of the fact that the American forces at Bastogne are surrounded, they've got to fly over enemy forces in order to get there. And the enemy forces are going to know that, oh, these aircraft have got they've got supplies on board that we really, really don't want these forces to have, because we're having a hard enough time breaking the perimeter as it is. If they get all these supplies, the situation for us is looking a little bit worse for wear. So the anti-aircraft fire is massive on the American troop carrier aircraft that are flying in to deliver these supplies to the Americans at Bastogne. And we lose 19 aircraft on the operation. So that's worse than Normandy, including the Freeport mission, for some of the wings anyway. It's not quite Market Garden numbers, but we're not talking about airborne operations over a number of days. So repulse is pretty costly to 9 Troop Carrier Command.
Because it's a concerted effort to drop a lot of supplies very quickly, isn't it, to shore up the defence?
Absolutely, yeah. So, again, you know, books like Don Burgett's talk about watching the flight of VC-47s come over low and slow, seeing a number of them, you know, catch fire, engine fires, fires in the wings, things like that, and watching them go down. But seeing these aircraft maintain an immaculate formation, dropping the supplies exactly where they need them to go. And as I say, it's the first time that for some of the members of the 101st anyway, particularly those that are still probably reeling from the misdrops in Normandy way back when, have gone, actually, these guys, they do have a lot more bottle than we might have given them credit for.
Because they wouldn't have seen the resupply attempts in and around Arnhem, where they took a battering as well. This was really the first time they were actually watching as opposed to leaping out of these aircraft, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's certainly the first opportunity where they really, like you say, did have chance just to stand in the snow-covered fields and just watch these aircraft come overhead. I mean, even during Market Garden, a huge proportion of the aerial resupply, as you know, was carried out by the 2nd Air Division, B-24s. You know, and they may have seen the effect of the flak on those aircraft then, but the resupply missions at Bastogne were really the first opportunity they had. And of course, we've got some amazing photos of it as well, you know, that have been in a million and one books over the years, but particularly, without meaning to plug it too much, volume two of Mine and Hand's book series on 9 Troop Carrier Command has got some incredible colour photos of the aerial resupply at Bastogne, which is, it's great from a, dare I say it, a geek's perspective, because in a colour photo, you can see all the different coloured parachutes that denote the different types of bundles that they're dropping from the aircraft, which is nice to see.
Which wasn't in Band of Brothers. They were all nice white.
No, that's it, yeah.
See, yeah, if you've got your hopes up for Masters of the Air, people, remember it's in the details. Let's get really geeky for a second, because over this period, retrofits are being done to the aircraft. Self-sealing tanks are put in after Normandy.
Yeah, gradually, yes.
Yeah, so because the C-47 is being worked on, upgraded, new ones are arriving because they're literally wearing the old ones out. But then two other aircraft start coming in at this time as well, which we need to talk about because it's going to plug what we do for part two whenever we get around to doing that. That won't be right away because I need to do more reading on that one.
Yeah.
Which is, he says, sitting here in a consolidated aircraft t-shirt, the C-109, which is the most weird B-24 ever, I think. It's a flying bomb.
Absolutely, yeah. And actually, it was... supposedly, the B-24 was quite a difficult plane to fly anyway. But the C-109 made that even more so. In fact, the 9 Troop Carrier Command quite quickly learnt to fly it without the nose tank and the tail tank.
We should just say it was a tanker aircraft to fly in fuel for the ground. It's a flying gas can, essentially, isn't it?
Yeah. So for those who are not familiar, the C-109 was essentially a B-24 that had all its turrets taken out. You know, anything that was in any way related to its job as a bomber taken out. And it was retrofitted with a load of these tanks inside that could be filled with what the Americans would call gasoline, what we would call fuel, I guess.
Petrol, you know.
Petrol. You're yeah. And it massively increased the amount of fuel, gasoline, that the 9 Troop Carrier Command could fly over to the continent. So one C-109 could carry the equivalent of essentially what about 10 or 11 C-47s could carry in jerry cans, basically. So 9 Troop Carrier Command start to take delivery of C-109s in the December of 1944. And of course, there's a period of transition training for the crew because they're used to flying twin-engine C-47s. And they've got very different flight characteristics. And so what the troop carrier groups were finding were they were being assigned bomber crews that had reached the end of their tours. And before they'd gone, they were sent home to the States. They were asked, or I would imagine more told, to go and sort of check in with these troop carrier groups and help them transition to four-engine aircraft. There was never a better demonstration of the reason why that was needed than an aerial collision that happened just north of RAF Barkston Heath in Lincolnshire, where a C-109 and a B-24J that had not been converted to a tanker collided and killed everybody on board both aircraft. And the reason why that happened was because the two aircraft flying in formation, and the pilot of the C-109 wasn't quite used to high bank turns in a four-engine aircraft, didn't know to apply more power, and the aircraft slipped down into the flight path of the other aircraft, and they collided.
Which was very common on the B-24 with that Davis wing. It had a high slip in turns, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And
to be very geeky about an airplane, I haven't covered yet and I need to, but
yeah, but it demonstrated that it was a very difficult aircraft to fly, and this transition training was extremely important. They also discovered, as I say, fairly early on that if you flew the aircraft with the nose, so there was a tank in the nose where there would otherwise have been a bombardier and a turret, and a tank in the tail where obviously you'd have had a tail gunner. Mine went blank there. I was thinking, did the B-24 have a tail on it? Turret? Yes, it did.
A powered one, didn't it?
Yes, it did, yeah. When they were full, the aircraft was almost impossible to fly, apparently. Which begs the question, why did they put them there? Did anybody think to test flying the aircraft whilst it was full? But anyway,
It was clearly numbers for. I'm going to be very cynical here. It was numbers for a contract. It was we can retrofit these aircraft and you can get.
I'd imagine so. Yeah.
That's how it usually works out.
Yeah. So it's as Boney says, it's a bit of a weird looking aircraft because it looks like a B-24 that somebody has scribbled out the turrets and all of the cool looking bits and just patched them up. But they served the purpose and they did a fairly decent job. And when the groups were assigned the C-109s, they triple the amount of gasoline they're flying to the front lines. So they kind of speak for themselves, really.
The other aircraft is the C-46, Curtiss Commando, yeah. Which I suppose we need to mention because it's done good service over the hump.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And where the key point is nobody's shooting at it. It comes to Europe. And again, it's an aircraft that is a step change on from the C-47, much higher payload.
Yeah.
Faster.
It was faster on one engine than the C-47 was. Yeah.
Which to be fair was a rare thing because it usually bursts into flames by the time. It was a hoped for thing. So it comes up a lot when we do our varsity thing. It had a huge, I don't say impact, but there's, put it like this. If you're ever watching a Market Garden, I'm stealing your line here, Market Garden documentary, and you see a, air quotes for the listener, Dakota going down in flames, that's not Market Garden. That's a C-46 during varsity. Because it's literally a baptism of fire, isn't it?
100%. On paper, the C-46 is a great aircraft because it's got modern engines on it that are significantly more powerful than the ones that power the C-47. It can fly faster than a C-47 on one engine. It was actually designed to be a four-engine aircraft, but the advancement in engine design and the power output that they could provide meant that it wasn't necessary. So it had a bigger wingspan than a B-17, which gives the listener an idea of just how big this thing was. It was unique in terms of it had what they called twin jump doors. So you could have, instead of having one row of paratroopers down the centre of a cabin that jumped out of one door like you had with a C-47, you would have two rows of paratroopers that were jumping out of either side of the aircraft, which meant that you could carry twice the number of paratroopers on board an aircraft. And what this gives you is it gives a troop carrier group the ability to deploy an entire regiment as opposed to just two battalions of airborne infantry, as they were sized back towards the end of World War II. So if you're an operational planner and the opportunity to utilise the C-46 comes up, you're looking at it on paper going, wow, this thing looks amazing. But then Varsity happens. And they realise it's not quite so good, not quite as good as they thought it might be.
I do want to say this, but it's like none of the lessons learned work its way through to the aircraft. You know, the wings the C-47 had vented wings, which basically we mean if it gets hit, it will expel fuel out.
Yeah.
Not terribly well, but it does, whereas the C-46 was an unvented wing, which basically meant it pooled in the wing root, and then if it got hit again, it basically turned the fuselage into a blowtorch. It's a horrible... When you start reading about Varsity, the stories of it are terrible. Frank Johnson, Canadian pilot who flew Typhoons, in his logbook for the Varsity mission, it's just flamers. Yeah, he. I have to look it up exactly, but he just says troop transports on fire, parachutes on fire.
Yeah,
that's the, you know, and he was flying flak suppression, so he was doing some pretty dangerous stuff. But his memory of that day when he got home to write up his logbook,
was watching those
fall out
of the sky. Yeah, I mean, it's mind blowing as well. For only one group in 9 Troop Carrier Command transitioned over to the C-46 before the end of hostilities in World War II. There was another group that did after the war ended, but it was the 313th Troop Carrier Group who'd flown missions over Sicily, Italy, Normandy, Market Garden. You know, they'd done it all, basically. Technically speaking, for the operation, they flew 72 aircraft. 73 aircraft were involved, but the 73rd, again, emphasises the difficulties with the aircraft, because it is a humongous aircraft. If you ever had the chance to stand next to one or underneath one or whatever, it's a huge aircraft, and it's got a massive...
If you've ever watched Ice Pilots, they've got...
Oh, absolutely, they fly them regularly, yeah. Mm. It's got a humongous vertical stabiliser that acts as a giant sail. So when the 313th were taken off from their airfield at Achille-le-Grand in France for Varsity, one of the aircraft takes a massive gust of crosswind and the pilot cannot bring the aircraft back under control. So this aircraft crashes into a load of parked vehicles and one of the undercarriages collapses and it ploughs through a load of tents and thankfully it doesn't kill anybody, but it writes the aircraft off. And this is before anything has happened, really. It's the start of the operation. So that aircraft, all of the paratroopers of the 513th Parachute Infantry Regiment have to jump off that aircraft like little lemmings and jump onto another one and hope that the same thing doesn't happen again. And thankfully it doesn't. So 72 aircraft end up flying the operation. And of the 72 that flew the operation, 19 of them are shot down, which is mind blowing.
Losing nearly a quarter of the aircraft on, well, it is, it's more than a quarter, isn't it? It's 23%.
It's mind-blowing.
No, 28%, sorry, I'm doing my maths wrong. Yeah, it's mad. Again, we're going to go into a lot more detail, but especially about how they set it up, because it's unlike Normandy, where there's a bit of a gap between the 101st and the 82nd, this is everybody in one big, essentially stream of paratroopers being dropped in a very short... It's a fascinating operation, one with some incredible tales and some terrifying ones of fiery airplanes. And you'll have to wait, dear listener, for when Adam and I can plan that one out, because there are so many moving parts in Varsity that I think we can't wing it as much as we've done tonight. The short notice I gave Adam for this pod. What's the books called, mate? As volume one's been out for a while, I have it in the post, which is going to be great, along with your book on the 82nd. So give us a plug for both of them.
Okay, so as I mentioned at the start, 9 Troop Carrier Command consisted of three wings. So when me and Hans started working on a pictorial history of 9 Troop Carrier Command, we decided that we would break each volume down to focus on one of the wings. We started with the 52nd Troop Carrier Wing, and being brutally honest with you, there's one of the main reasons for that is because the 52nd Wing traditionally dropped the 82nd Airborne Division into combat. So I already knew I was already quite well versed on the 52nd Wing, and it felt like we could slide into that one quite nicely. The other reason was because I live in the East Midlands, and the groups of the 52nd Troop Carrier Wing were based in Lincolnshire. There was one in Rutland and there was one in Northamptonshire. So they're all fairly close to me. The volume that's coming up is on the 53rd Troop Carrier Wing, who were more tied into deploying the 101st Airborne Division into combat, although they did fly the gliders that carried the 82nd into combat for Normandy. So essentially what the volumes are is the reason that they're as big as they are is because they're a pictorial history. We've been so incredibly lucky to get hold of some amazing photo collections. I mean, Boney knows what some of her collections include, because whenever an obscure British aircraft or whatever comes up, I'll send it to Boney and I'll send it to Matt Willis, and we'll have a good look at it and yeah, take some enjoyment out of trying to work out whose aircraft it is and why it's there and all sorts of things like that.
The photos that Adam's been sharing are just absolutely amazing. There's some really, really cool, weird stuff.
Yeah, I mean, some of them you look at and you go, why is that on a troop carrier airfield? But then, you know, I'm glad that they were. But essentially what the books cover is the history of 9 Troop Carrier Command from operations it launched from England. Mm-hmm. So the volumes won't pay a huge amount of focus on operations like Dragoon, because obviously even though the aircraft did fly from England to Italy to do it, the operation was launched from Italy. And the same with Varsity. The lion's share of the groups that flew Varsity flew from France. So Varsity does get covered, but not in huge detail. It more focuses on the operations carried out from England for Normandy and Market Garden and Repulse and all the areas in between. And we try to give as much insight into what life on these airfields was like for these guys, and what life in the UK was like for them. And there's lots of photos of them on furlough around London and Nottingham and Lincolnshire, and yeah, you know, all the stuff the Americans did.
And the other one, which I'm actually probably looking forward to more, is your Suddenly They Were Gone, which is all about the 82nd in Nottinghamshire and Lincolnshire, which I guess you can call it more of a social history of the impact of the 82nd showing up incognito, wasn't it? And then, the effect they had here in the UK.
Yeah, basically, it's just, I mean, I was born in Derby, but I was from the age of 8, I was raised in Leicestershire. And so some of the units of the 82nd were camped prior to Neptune, prior to D-Day, and prior to Operation Market Garden in some of the villages that are 15, 20 minutes from where I live. So ever since I was 16, started collecting testimonies of veterans about their time in the UK, started speaking to locals who remember the Americans in the area, and essentially just decided to do the opposite of what everyone else does, which is focus on the division's time in combat and focus on the time that they spent in England. Because invariably what I found talking to a lot of veterans is that, understandably, some were very reluctant to talk about their time in combat, but all of them were more than happy to talk about their time in England. So there's a lot of fun stories in there, a lot of funny stories in there. There's some not so funny stuff in there, but it's it was an interesting thing to work on.
So as an 82nd guy, why have you got 101st reproduction?
I have got lots of 82nd stuff on this side of the room.
I keep getting distracted by the jump knife. I'm sorry.
Oh, where can you see that? I can't. I can only see part of what my screen is. Yeah, I've got jump knives up there. I've got a V-42 stiletto up there, which was the American version of the commando knife. Can't remember what the commando knife. Fairbairn Sykes knife. I've got a machete up there. Yeah, I've got various bits and bobs. Most of my 82nd stuff is on that side of the wall. That's just up there. And I've also got that's modern day 101st. Subdued patches in that frame there, with a flag that was flown over Afghanistan in an Apache, as you do. So that's a bit off topic.
Yes, that is a bit. Right, Adam, this has been fantastic. We're gonna. It's been too long. This pod has been going for a year now. We've had Willis on twice. That's not fair. And it's taken me too long to get you on. So this thank you problem. So much for jumping on.
Before we go, can I just, because I wrote them down, can I really quickly just read a couple of stats out to you?
Oh, yes, you found the stats, do it.
Purely because they are absolutely mind-blowing.
Go for it.
So, in 1944, so we're talking 1 year of the war, 9 Troop Carrier Command airlifted 121,000 US tons of supplies, which I was amazed to learn is £242 million. Of supplies to the front lines. It gets better.
Sorry,
242 million pounds of supplies.
242 million. So that's 242. That's 100 million kilos.
If that's what you think it is, yeah.
2.2 pounds. Yeah, so about 100 million. Flipping heck.
Yeah. They also carried 6.1 million gallons of gasoline in the year of 1944 to the front lines. And I was very impressed with working this one out. That's enough. It's enough fuel to power the average family car in the UK for 35,000 years. Which is incredible. And it just makes you think, how much gasoline did the Allies get through in World War II?
They weren't the most fuel efficient.
No.
They didn't have the stop-start thing that we've got in our cars.
No. So here's the final one. Okay. They carried 50 million pounds of ammunition to the front lines in World War II, right? And it equates to, if obviously they carried all sorts of different ammunition during World War II, but it equates to 2 billion rounds of M1 ammunition.
Whoa.
It's crazy numbers. Crazy numbers when you think about it. But I thought it would be worth ringing off those numbers before we called it a day.
That's a perfect way to wrap it up. Mate, thank you so much for joining us. We'll get that varsity thing in the diary. But
absolutely,
thank you so much.
Yeah.
And thanks, Soph, for letting me bore you on a Thursday evening.
No, it's no problem. Anytime.
I honestly think Adam is a bit of a rock star. And I'm not just saying that because he's a mate and the last of our AV Geeks group chat to come on to the new show, which is not acceptable. But that's why he is the 50th episode of this podcast. So thank you so much, Adam, for being my 50th episode. Thank you all for sticking with us for 50 episodes of me and various wonderful people waffling on about airplanes. Now, like I said in the pod, I'm finally getting my hard copies of Adam's books. They're arriving soon. They haven't arrived yet, so I can't wave them around if you're watching the video version, which is handy because they weigh a ton. They're probably going to put my back out. But they're coming. They're available from Overlord Publishing, and the link for that is in the descriptions below. We're going to be doing some things around the launch of his new book next year, plus more C-47 stuff, so keep your eyes peeled for that. Also, I just say follow Adam because he puts up some of these incredible images that he finds on his various Twitter feeds and Blue Sky, all of that. Like I said, give him a follow. He's great. He's also one of my co-hosts on the In Hiatus Boundary of Disaster podcast, which we do with Matt Willis and my daughter, Ellie. So that's going to be coming back. We're going to be talking motor racing, but not Formula One, because that's why it's on hiatus, because yeah, we're all jaded. But on the Damcasters, we're going to keep going with aircraft. And next week, we have a fantastic guest in the form of aerobatic pilot Melanie Assels, who's my fellow Pima Air and Space Museum sponsoree. So that was a lot of fun to record. That's up next week. I have to thank Pima for their continued support of the pod. They're going to be continuing with us for a while, which is great. So many thanks to Scott and the team out in Tucson. And of course, thank you for your support. Liking, subscribing, putting stars into your podcast app of choice really does help. The algorithms do listen to these things. So thank you for that. The reviews that you've been putting up have been really nice. I'm loving the conversation as well. We're going to have to do some things so that we can do more chatting and maybe expand that AV Geeks group chat. Watch this space, Discord. Who knows? We will get cracking on it. So thank you ever so much for your continued support. If you want to get all this stuff early, you can become a Damcasteer for £3 a month plus a bit of VAT at the bottom tiers over on Patreon. Links in the description below. And of course, you get stickers and bookmarks and things, which is just my way of saying thanks so much for your support, because it really does mean a lot. It helps us keep ticking over. Until next time, when we return with Melanie to talk about extras, Red Bull Air Races, World Championships, do take care of yourselves, and thanks for listening.
The Damcasters is hosted and produced by Matt Bowe and is a Boney Abroad podcast production. To learn more about our podcasts and check out our previous episodes, head to www.thedamcasterspod.com.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.